This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next two guests have studied the food system and what it means to have a system that is equitable and sustainable. What are the problems in the system and what are the solutions? With us is Raj Patel. He is a research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, The Value of Nothing, and The History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. He also co-hosts a fortnightly food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Saru Jayaraman is also with us. She's the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include The Accidental American, Behind the Kitchen Door, and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. Raj Patel and Saru Jayaraman are contributors to The Nation magazine's special issue, The Future of Food, Setting the Table for the Next Generation.
So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us. You guys have done a special issue for The Nation magazine about just sustainable food systems. I thought we should start with what we're talking about. When we say just sustainable food systems, Raj Patel, what does that mean for you?
I think we're all sort of agreed that in order for something to be sustainable, it needs to be more than just a process of being able to get the food out of the ground reliably season after season. For it to be sustainable, we need to be talking both about ecological and social sustainability. You can't continue harvesting as we have while dependent on carbon being spewed into the atmosphere, destroying the possibility of future generations from being able to grow food. But similarly, you can't depend, as the food system does, on the exploitation of workers from farm to fork in order to be able to get your organic and locally grown food. So sustainability is necessarily both a social and an ecological term.
So then necessarily connected with a just food system.
That's right. So the idea of justice is, I think, one that's incredibly wide, right? I mean, when we think about justice, we need to be thinking not just about our present generation, as Saru's work just shows so magnificently, you know, treating workers properly right now, but also thinking about future generations, about what's fair to as yet unborn generations, but also thinking about the past, about atoning for the way that the food system now is built on centuries of slavery and colonialism.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in for Saru. Why don't you tie history into this present day and where we are today as a result of this, how they're all connected?
You know, the existence of the food system in America relies on the labor of 20 million workers. One in six American workers works in food. It is by far the largest, collectively the largest private sector employment in the United States. And yet it is the lowest paying. In particular, within that group of 20 million, the vast majority, 12 million of those workers are restaurant workers alone. Forget the rest of the food system. Alone, the restaurant industry is the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. And yet it is actually the restaurant industry is the absolute lowest paying employer in the U.S. Every year, the Department of Labor puts out a list of the 10 lowest paying jobs, and 7 of the 10 are restaurant jobs. And we've discovered that that really is due to the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which represents the Fortune 500 chains, and which, as it turns out, if you look back in history, really it's the predecessor forms of this trade lobby fought to be able to hire newly freed slaves post-emancipation and pay them a $0 wage and let them live on customer tips. And that idea was actually codified into law so that the first tipped workers in the United States were mostly Black. They were actually given a $0 wage from their employer and made to live on tips. And we went from a $0 wage in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour, the current federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the U.S. And it's between $2.13 and $7.50 in 43 states in the United States. It's an abysmal, ridiculous wage that it forces a mostly female workforce to live off tips and really, you know, tolerate the absolute worst sexual harassment of any industry because they're having to feed their families on tips. These are not young workers. They're mostly in their mid-30s. 40% of them are single moms, and they're having to feed their families on the whims of customers who often mistreat them in various ways because they know they have that power. So really, when we talk about a just and sustainable food system, I think I would say two things. One, you cannot have sustainable food without sustainable wages and working conditions for the people who cook, prepare, and serve that food. And certainly once we know that that whole system is based in a legacy of slavery and a source of sexual harassment, I don't understand how we could have a sustainable restaurant as we do in America, sustainable food restaurant that pays its workers $2 and $3 an hour. But that is a very common thing. Some of our favorite organic, local, and sustainable food restaurants pay $2 and $3 to their workers. But the second thing I really have to say is sustainable has another meaning to it, which is that sustainable means sustained, that it can go on, it can continue. And when 1 in 3 Americans at this moment works full-time or more than full-time and lives in poverty, and we're heading to, within 10 years, a moment in which 1 in 2 working Americans will work full-time and live in poverty, you cannot sustain any food system when half of the country cannot afford to eat or eat out, let alone have a sustainable food system sustained. So I don't know if that made sense, but there's just no way for this system to continue as it's continuing right now, unless we address the wage and the working conditions of workers in the food system.
I wonder, before we go on to other types of food workers, and Raj, you wrote about some of these in your piece, particularly the banana workers. Saru, have you looked at the United States treatment of its restaurant workers, food workers, compared to other countries in similar situations? Is it unique in how poorly it treats its restaurant staff, for example?
Certainly, labor exploitation is not unique to the United States, but it must be understood that we quite often set the standards for the world. And particularly with the chains that are mostly based here and have formed this thing called the National Restaurant Association and have lately formed something called the Multinational Hospitality and Restaurant Association, the MHRA. And this idea of paying workers this ridiculously low wage definitely is a result of our unique racial caste system in the United States, of our legacy of slavery. And that now the MHRA is working actively to spread this idea of a lower wage for tipped workers in many other countries. They've been fighting for it in Canada. They've been fighting for it in other parts of the world. So we're not unique in the exploitation of food workers. We are unique in the sense that we set the standards, and certainly the major corporations that are driving this exploitation worldwide are based here and have won kind of these ridiculous wage agreements here and are trying to push that on the rest of the world.
Raj, you noted in your piece in The Nation about the other end of this, which is the production and what happened to banana workers in Central America, for example. Tell us how that ties into sustainable food systems and just food systems.
The idea here is that, for example, people are buying fair trade coffee and fair trade tea and fair trade bananas. And the idea there is that when you're buying fair trade, what you're doing is you hope giving workers just a little bit more, or giving farmers rather, a little bit more so that they can survive the very low commodity prices that are being imposed on them by these big multinationals. And so I buy fair trade coffee because, you know, what's the alternative? You know, bastard coffee, the kind of coffee where that involves the exploitation of children because I like my coffee bitter. No, you buy fair trade. But the problem is not in the idea that people oughtn't to be able to survive. The problem is twofold. On the one hand, this is a very unilateral move. It's a sort of pennies, you know, so crumbs from the table from us, a sort of small token of recognition that we feel a little bit guilty that people are in general in conditions of extreme exploitation. But the deeper problem is that we never stop to think about why it is that large parts of Central America are the United States fruit bowl. How is it that we're okay with the conversion of land in large parts of the world to suit us? And you know, some people say, well, you know, what, if we don't buy their bananas, what will they do? Poor things. And of course, that's an utterly rubbish argument. I mean, it's to paper over the fact that it took violence and state power from the United States to make it possible for the United Fruit Company, a company that was known locally as El Pulpo, the octopus, for its tentacles into various sort of houses of power to be able to establish itself in the Caribbean. And, you know, today we have the vestiges of that history when we think about terms like banana republic. When we say that some place is a banana republic, what we sometimes mean is the idea that, although it has the nominal sort of view of being a democracy, in fact, you know, it's a general who's in charge and he's our man and he's, you know, he's a company man. And the idea of banana republics emerges because the United Fruit Company paid and made sure that the kinds of people who were in charge of these countries were ones who didn't want things like land reform. And so when a democratically elected president started to find that there were some bits of the banana plantations that weren't being used, and he said, look, we'll buy them from you and we'll redistribute them to the poor, the United Fruit Company was so alarmed that they called John Foster Dulles at the CIA, and the CIA ignited a coup that then resulted in a civil war in which 250,000 people were killed. That you don't get from fair trade. Acknowledging that history, you don't get from fair trade. And that, as I was saying, right now the US is pushing these heinous trade agreements on other countries. Before, the US has been doing similar things by just forcing US companies on and US governance on large parts of the Caribbean. And that question is a much trickier one to address when we think about the US culpability here, because really the answer is that we ought to be paying the countries that we have in many ways turned to our convenience and in the process killed hundreds of thousands. We ought to be paying reparation.
You mentioned the trade agreements right now and how harmful they are, given what the United States has now with Donald Trump at the helm, trying to or promising to dismantle these trade agreements. Is that something that should be done?
If you're asking me, Maria, I think absolutely that the international peasant movement, La Via Campesina, is very keen on taking agriculture out of the World Trade Organization and out of NAFTA. NAFTA was explicitly aimed at kicking Mexican peasants off their land so that large-scale agriculture could produce cheap food to then sell to the United States. But removing, you know, the U.S. from NAFTA does nothing to redistribute the land that was taken from these peasants. So, you know, without that concomitant kind of redistribution of land back to the poor, getting out of a trade agreement, and particularly the way that Trump's going to do it, is a half measure that has the possibility of leaving poor people worse off. I certainly think it's a good idea for countries to be able to have sovereignty in a way that trade agreements deny them. But the way that Trump is doing it, of course, is as part of a sort of xenophobic plan, not to be able to redistribute goods to the poor, but in order for the richest corporations in this country to be able to have their way on new and newly renegotiated terms.
So much of what the two of you are talking about really ties back into these very large publicly traded corporations and the power that they have. So then the question becomes, you know, how do you deal with these really large international, multinational corporations that wield so much power? Saru, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, you fight them. You know, like, we are an organization that has been up against one of the most powerful trade lobbies, I would say, in the world, the National Restaurant Association. It's been named one of the top 10 lobbying groups in Congress. We call it the other NRA because most people know about the Rifle Association, but just don't know how powerful the Restaurant Association is on a lot of different issues. And, you know, we're not a huge group. We started as a little scrappy group just 15 years ago, and over the last 15 years have organized and fought and exposed them in so many ways that they have felt threatened enough to attack us. So, I mean, they've spent at this point over $10 million trying to shut us down, from lawsuits to congressional investigations, going after our funders, going after our tax exempt status, going after me personally, putting my children's pictures up on their attack website. I mean, they will do anything to stop workers from demanding their rights or asking for more than the $2 and $3 that they are lobbying. You know, they've lobbied so well to keep wages at. And so we need to expose trade lobbies and huge corporations and their activities. We need to fight against them. And we really, mostly, especially need to be holding accountable elected officials in both parties that have rolled over to really facilitate the power of these huge corporations. You know, unfortunately, in our case, we've seen elected officials in both parties kowtow to the Restaurant Association because they fund their campaigns and because they know they'll attack hard if they don't do everything that they want. And so we, the people, need to be showing our support to electeds that stand up to the Restaurant Association and Big Ag and large corporations, and also holding accountable any electeds that don't do that. And that's the only way that we're going to actually have a true democracy rather than a nation controlled completely by corporate kleptocrats.
Raj Patel, what would you say to that?
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we have, as we record now, the storm breaking about Harvey Weinstein, for example. And, you know, one of the things that Saru's research has shown is the way in which, the structure of low wages and tipped work and the forum of the restaurant as it is, it is the perfect cocktail for sexual assaults to be happening. For elected officials to be condoning that, the enabling environment of a million Harvey Weinsteins is the sort of shame that we ought to be bringing to their door right now.
Yeah, I imagine that's tough given that the president of the United States is, for lack of a better term, the groper in chief.
But I do think that while perhaps our president cannot feel the emotion of shame, that there are ways in which the elected officials who side with the National Restaurant Association can be made to pay a very high political cost.
And I just want to chime in that the reason we have a president who's a groper in chief is because you have millions of working people across America that feel completely disgusted, disillusioned, and disengaged with the political system precisely because they see elected officials rolling over to corporate interests. So so many people talk about, oh, people voted for Trump. I mean, the truth everybody knows is most people in America did not vote in this election. And it was like the lowest turnout ever. And I know from our population of 12 million restaurant workers, it's because they feel just totally turned off by the powers that be and the way in which they kowtow to the Restaurant Association. So, rather, you know, there's such an inclination, you know, among elites, I would say even in the food movement, in quotes, to want to be somewhat centrist and not be too bold or too progressive. And I actually think that is the wrong intuition. The intuition should be, we should be listening, especially to working people in this moment that income inequality has reached this climax, this zenith in the United States. We need to be listening to working people and showing them that we will deliver for them in order to not have a Trump get elected. And that's what we haven't done. And I do want to bring up one thing that I brought up in the Nation piece that's a really good example of how the National Restaurant Association is now wielding its power and what working people can do and everybody can do. You know, the Restaurant Association has gotten together with President Trump and his Department of Labor to announce new proposed regulation that's already been submitted to the White House that any restaurant that pays a worker a full minimum wage in this country, that's $7.25 an hour, gets to wholly and legally steal its workers' tips, keep its workers' tips. Meaning a restaurant can charge you, give you a bill and you pay a tip and you think it's going to the worker, but now legally with Trump's new rule, the boss can take that tip that you gave, thinking it's going to the workers, and go buy a Mercedes. I mean, that is what is being proposed. It's going to be submitted to the White House for review. It will come up for public comment later this year, early next year. It's already been made law in the 10th Circuit. It is outrageous. It should outrage anybody. You know, it overturns 80 years of law saying that tips are the property of workers. It should outrage workers, of course, but it should outrage consumers because it's consumer fraud. And it's just another example of collusion between corporate America and just complete control of our democracy. And so we need people to stand up and speak out and say, absolutely not. We don't want our tips going to the boss. And that is, again, Democrats or others who stand up and say that is wrong, I think will find that they are going to have a lot more support than those that just roll over and let the Restaurant Association or other corporations do their bidding.
In some of the jurisdictions in the U.S. where you've seen the minimum wage go up to, say, $15 an hour, and I think there have been a handful of those, have they included restaurant workers in this or have they excluded them?
only 7 states have included restaurant workers. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska got rid of this legacy of slavery, this lower wage for tipped workers. In California, it's been 50 years since they got rid of this. In the other 43 states, including New York and Washington, D.C. and Massachusetts, every time the wage has gone up, including the new efforts to go to 15. So in New York and D.C., 15 was passed. But in all of those states, tipped workers were left out or even saw their workers decline, their wages decline. And so what you essentially have is legislation that raises wages for everybody except the poorest women in the state. They're throwing the poorest women under the bus every time they raise the minimum wage. And again, it's due to the power of the Restaurant Association and its control even over Democrats who move these minimum wage bills, who then the Democrats, we need to give the Restaurant Association its exemption so that their workers are not covered by this $15. And that is precisely why we as people need to be holding those elected officials accountable.
With regards to the future of food, what is it we're facing with farming, ownership, diseases that are happening on the farms, climate that is making food security heightened? What are we facing in terms of food sustainability?
If we're thinking just in terms of climate change, then we're already heading towards a rather perilous situation in which productivity is destined to fall in the United States. And that's without even thinking about the rise of certain kinds of weed resistance and the certain kinds of transformations in U.S. ecology that makes it inevitable that farms will be less productive here. But of course, the people who are worst hit by this are the people who have nothing to do with climate change. If you look at the map of the most vulnerable populations around the world, it's folk in sub-Saharan Africa, in Southeast Asia and South Asia, whose contribution to climate change has been utterly minimal, and who will nonetheless be the climate refugees, and climate refugees have already started to cross borders, but who will be the people who suffer the hardest while we are relatively insulated with the wealth that we've accumulated through centuries of being able to burn as much carbon as we like. So the long-term outlook in terms of climate alone is one that bends towards injustice. And again, you know, that will mean to some extent food price hikes, and that will ripple through the United States because, as Saru was saying, with so many people in the United States already food insecure, we're at 50 million at the moment, and with so many people who are working poor in the United States, the inequalities that climate change is already foisting on the world and which will be felt much worse outside this country will also be felt here. And again, it's through the structure of social inequality in the United States that the horrors of climate change will be magnified and unequally distributed. And one could say the same thing about the dangerous state of meat production, for example. And another thing that's happening in the Trump administration is the National Chicken Council is looking to speed up line speeds for workers who are involved in chicken processing, to raise the number of chickens passing inspectors to, 160, 180 birds per minute. And it's almost certain that at those higher speeds, as we've seen in other parts of the world, when you increase line speeds, that way diseases thrive and pass inspectors by. And that doesn't augur well for the food system either. And again, you know, the diseases that propagate through the food system are made worse by the kinds of things that the Restaurant Opportunity Center has observed, where, you know, if you're being paid very little, you have no healthcare, and you have to work, then you'll go to work even if you're sick, and you'll go to work if you're sick with H1N1. And again, the food system becomes a more dangerous and toxic place because of the inequality foisted by these large corporations.
You had also said at another interview about the sixth extinction we're all facing, that it's human demand for meat that's really driving a lot of this extinction. Can you tie that together for us?
Sure. Let's take the example of chicken. The original chicken, it comes from Southeast Asia, from the jungles of Southeast Asia. That bird and the indigenous people used to rely on it have been not rendered extinct, but 50% of the original chicken species are now extinct. Instead, we have government breeding programs that now have chickens that are bred with breasts that are so large that they can't walk. In order to be able to fund and feed these animals, large parts of the world fall under the plow. And so that means the Brazilian Cerrado, a very dynamic ecosystem, gets converted into monocultural soy farming. And when you clear these habitats and you replace it by monoculture, you render species extinct. the demand for meat, again, is linked and requires fuel and investment and the transformation of large parts of the planet's surface. And the industrialization, the industrial meat production system, requires that there are just two or three species that interact that bring us our whatever it is. And the consequence of that is that there's less and less room on the planet for biodiversity. And so certainly the consumption of meat is very much linked to transformations in habitat. And certainly the industrial massive sort of meatification of the world's diet is linked to species extinction in a very deep way.
You know, the last thing I would like to cover has to do with the automation of both the farming industry and the food service industry. So I happened to notice a restaurant when I was in Washington, D.C., in which there were no food workers, in which you go in and you press some buttons and you order your food and a machine prepares it and you look up on the wall and it tells you which slot from which you pull your food out. Similarly, there was one in the airport, it might have been Athens, in which similarly, no food workers. They set up iPads, you order your food through the iPad, you say what to hold, what you want, you pay through the iPad, and that's done. There was an article in a newspaper recently in which farms are now being automated to that degree. What do we see in our future here? Saru, why don't you start on that?
This is a favorite argument of the National Restaurant Association. They love to say that if you raise wages, we'll just automate, you know, everything and replace restaurant workers with robots. And in the restaurant industry, at least, which, as I mentioned, is the largest and fastest growing sector of the food system, but also the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the entire U.S. economy, that is simply not true. Automation is not replacing jobs in the restaurant industry. In fact, the regions where we've seen the greatest automation in the restaurant industry, we've seen actually the fastest job growth. So in our industry, people generally actually go to restaurants because they want to be served by human beings. And it has not actually happened that automation has replaced jobs. In many ways, actually, automation has actually just increased jobs because the restaurants that are not automated continue to have workers. And then the automated restaurants, nobody's actually fully automated. There are always workers involved somehow in an automated restaurant. And so those are additional jobs. So our industry just continues to explode. There's absolutely no indication that that will decline anytime soon. And what that points to is the fact that what we really need is to increase wages. The industry is actually going through the worst labor shortage in the history of the industry because workers simply cannot afford to stay in one place. Employers are dying to find, attract, and retain workers. And so they're having to figure out that we have so many high road restaurants that have joined our association and they're calling for higher wages in the industry because everybody on the leading edge of the industry is beginning to realize this business model is just not sustainable. We can't keep workers. And really, again, the future of the food system depends on changing this business model so that the industry can continue and, frankly, the nation's economy can survive and that there is a food system because there won't be when half, as I said, half the country can't afford to eat.
Raj Patel, anything you would add to that?
Well, I mean, the stretch for automation in the fields is sort of the extension of the transformation of farmers as botanists and as experimenters into farmers as technical kind of chemistry managers and robot maintainers. It involves, to some extent, the de-skilling of what it is to be nurturing life and to be connected to life, and instead a transformation towards turning fields into these fully automated factories. I think that particularly if we're interested in surviving the sixth extinction and the surviving climate change, what we need is diversification. And the knowledge of people who are tending these living beings in the fields needs to be recognized and the wages there need to be raised as well. So rather than solve the labor shortage that we're seeing also in the fields right now, and again, this is a sort of a corollary of the sort of Trump immigration issues, but the labor shortages in the fields are being purported at some level to be solved by bringing robots into the fields. But all you're doing is consolidating a monocultural agricultural system that can't survive, just can't survive, as we're seeing with these extreme weather events around the country. Monocultures are really bad at surviving extreme weather events, but diversified farming systems are much better. Diversified farming systems require skill and labor and well-paid labor at that. And moving away from the disaster of monoculture towards a system that recognizes and values skilled labor, I think is tremendously important. But to fight that, you have to fight the chemistry industry. And that's a story for another time.
Let me thank you both for your time, for your research, and for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Raj Patel, he's a research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, The Value of Nothing, and The History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. He also co-hosts a fortnightly food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Saru Jayaraman is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include The Accidental American, Behind the Kitchen Door, and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. Raj Patel and Saru Jayaraman are contributors to The Nation magazine's special issue, The Future of Food, Setting the Table for the Next Generation.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.